It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 6.1.
Looking forward to some sexy demon time in our spats and corsets as we traverse the mirrorverse.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have with us today Michael Jordan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
So we were talking about off podcast, so we should do this first. People may be shocked to know you have the same name as a certain basketball player.
Yes.
And yet you're a woman. So explain this.
My name is Michael. It has a final E that is silent. Other than that, it's just like the man's name. My mother was sure that would render it feminine. As I was saying, nobody in grade school disagreed, but there it is. It's my name. I've fought for it. I'm hanging on to it. And I then married a Mr. Jordan. And for years, I used to tell people I'm the real one. He's the imposter. But actually, since he was about 11 years old when I became Michael Jordan.
That's hilarious. So presumably you're not quite as tall as the other Michael Jordan.
Much shorter and a complete klutz.
That's too funny. What is the, I have to ask, what's the origin of Michael as a girl's name in your family?
I asked my mother that every day for 69 years, and she never came up with a reliable answer. Sometimes she told me it's biblical, and it is biblical, except my mother never read the Bible. She hated religion. I thought it might be a family name, but I didn't know my father's people. My parents were divorced when I was 2. And when I finally met my father, when I was about 25, I discovered he thought my name was Michaela. So I have no explanation for it. It's just there. One of those random cosmic strikes that make us what we are.
That's fantastic.
It's fascinating. Cool. So let's get started off with the proper questions. So what kind of drew you to writing, and why sexy demons in a Victorian setting? Is it just the clothes?
Not just the clothes, though the clothes are kind of cool. I wish I had the figure that could get away with that kind of a dress. The truth is, when I sat down to write, and it's really embarrassing how little awareness I had of where I was going or what I was doing, I was just going to write a short story about a man named Jacob and a succubus. And it had to be in the Victorian era because we live in a very freewheeling, sexualized society, and if I said, oh, it's about a supernatural creature that can look whatever you want it to look like and comes and has sex with you at night, everybody would say, well, that sounds hot, cool, how do I sign on? It wasn't going to be scary. A succubus has to be scary. So I put it in the Victorian era where they were still scared of that kind of thing.
That's awesome.
That's the best explanation for a Victorian setting I have ever heard.
Well, thank you. Truth is, the Victorian setting sort of took over the novel. There are times when I felt like I was writing more about the Victorian era than about my characters or their story.
Right. That actually leads us to our next question, because, I mean, I'm not an expert on Victorian novels, but this definitely has that feel. It's very Victorian. And it's very much like a Victorian pulp. You use the correct racial epithets, which is problematic to an extent, but accurate. So what obviously you just said why you chose Victorian, but how did it become such a major part of it? And what kind of research did you have to do to get that authentic feel?
Now, part of it was my grandmother. I grew up when my grandmother did a lot of the babysitting and a lot of the carrying baby care. She was, in her heart, a Victorian. Technically, in terms of era, she was an Edwardian. But she was financially well off enough to be behind her own times. And she really believed in all that stuff. She had the furniture. She had the manners. She wanted me to have a debut. I told her to save the money. But I grew up reading Victorian novels because the safest way to stay out of trouble in her house, not that she didn't love me, but her house was just filled with little breakable knickknacks that were worth more than I was. And so I just curled up in the library with a book, and all her books were 19th century. To this day, I've been accused of occasionally talking like a Victorian novel, and that's in conversation. There was a lot of research, but less than you might think, because somewhere along the line, I picked a great deal of this up already. And the rest of it, when I say I wanted it to be Victorian because I wanted their morals, I see a lot of novels where a so-called Victorian heroine, is wearing the dress and she's in the right furniture, but she acts like a 20th century woman. I needed not just my characters, but my audience, whoever you are, dear audience, to get the same feel of repression. And so I just kept piling on detail after detail. And looking back, I realized many of them weren't exactly relevant, but they made the period feel right. If I'm writing a scene about a dinner table conversation in the 20th century, everybody knows the references to Star Wars and Monty Python and whatever. But in the Victorian era, they don't talk about Star Wars and Monty Python. They talk about Gilbert and Sullivan and the Burton Speak Expeditions. So there got to be more and more of this corroborative detail.
That's actually an interesting point, the fact that in a lot of, it's due largely to this rise of steampunk, which takes the Victorian world, but kind of exempts it from the Victorian morals. Not completely, they're part of the conversation, but particularly the women in steampunk act much more, as you said, 20th century.
Exactly. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Exactly. It's not that I don't enjoy steampunk. I've read quite a bit of it and I think it's fun, but it's not the same thing as authentic Victoriana. And they'd be in almost the same position as your 21st century New Yorker when they were confronted with the succubus. They wouldn't be afraid of it. They wouldn't view this as evil. It wouldn't be a threat. I needed real Victorian for that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And this kind of related to this is my question about footnotes, because this book does have footnotes. Not as many, or well, actually endnotes. I've realized that's a totally different thing. It has endnotes, and you make a lot of references in your book to like painters and scientists and explorers that would have been popular during the time. And I also appreciated that things like when they were talking about Cecily and her potential condition, and also with the main character, what is his name?
Jacob,
excuse me, and also his mental condition, that you didn't start throwing in sort of like contemporary psychology terms, because they would not have existed. Like the closest thing they had in the late 1800s would have been like, well, he has a nervous condition. Like that would have been what they would have had. And I really appreciated that kind of like that detail.
Thank you very much. The footnotes themselves were sort of modeled on MacDonald Fraser, because he had all this wonderful detail, and you do have to explain it, but you also, if you're going to put footnotes in, you got to make the footnotes interesting too. So I had fun with them.
Oh, who is MacDonald Fraser?
Oh, George MacDonald Fraser. He wrote the Flashman novels.
Oh, okay, okay.
And if you aren't familiar with the novels, which are just long ago enough that maybe they're no longer everybody's current fave, have you seen the movie Royal Flash? It was based on a Flashman novel.
I have not.
Now I feel like an idiot. I'm going to have to go find these novels and that movie.
Many, many years ago, when my grandfather was a kid, there was a popular series of novel called Tom Brown's School Days. Please do not go look it up. They are deathly dull. They were just awful. But my grandfather liked them a lot. And the bad guy in Tom Brown's School Days was called Harry Flashman. Now, I forget the exact time when George MacDonald Fraser was writing. I was reading them in the 80s, I guess. And he picked up Harry Flashman and made him the hero of his series of novels. And he's this hopeless wreck, he's a coward who keeps getting credit for being the bravest man in the army. And he screws anything that moves. But he is hideously jealous of his beautiful wife. And they're wonderfully fun. And yes, you have to go back a few years to pick them up, but they're well worth it.
Yeah, I just looked them up on Wikipedia, and they span over like 50 years. He wrote a bunch in the 60s and then later and later. So yeah, it's very interesting. I'll have to check these out.
I mean, the nice thing about the particular nice thing about the footnotes is that comparative to the Doctor Strange and Mr. Norrell, or is it Mr. Norrell and Doctor Strange? I always forget.
Doctor Norrell. Doctor Strange and Mr. Norrell. I love
that
book.
Right. Fantastic book. And it had the same use of footnotes as adding to the layers of the world building. And I think that was the nice thing about the fact that you included them, because even if people didn't catch the reference immediately, the fact that you had, and Dr. Norrell, Mr. Strange, whatever, those are made up footnotes. I mean, that's all hers.
Yes.
Which was fascinating, and it was very nicely done. But the nice thing about this novel is that it has the accuracy portion. So you know that it's very much set in, you know, that it's set in reality, even if the magic is very much not reality. So it was a very nice inclusion to me. And it helped me get involved in that Victorian feel. So just a ramble there.
Well, thank you very much. Part of the accuracy was intended to cover the magic itself. All the magic is authentic to the era, except perhaps for the actual nature of the demon itself. But they're mirrors, and, well, you will recall that there are several footnotes about Madame Blavatsky, who was the hot psychic of the day, and what she was up to and her friends. But there's also, again, like the nervous disorder, because they didn't have any psychological terms, I had to fight very hard to keep from putting more modern concepts of magic into the book.
Actually, since you brought up the magic system, I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about how you constructed this system, because a lot of the kinds of things that you play with in this would have been, like, things like seances, would have been kind of semi-common during this time as a kind of, like, bourgeois, like, exploration. Like, let's have a seance party. And there's a lot of folklore and all of these kinds of things you've kind of cobbled together in a very sort of clever way. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about how you sort of went about constructing all of that.
This is probably the era where I did the most real sit down and read a book research instead of checking it up on Wikipedia and asking my family members and things like that, because I didn't really know anything about Blavatsky or the Order of the Golden Dawn. My husband knows about, my husband's a big fan of weird stuff, Fortean phenomenon, and he knew a lot about Golden Dawn. But all I knew was I needed the succubus to work. And the mirror came in when I needed it, straight out of, the Snow White thing. I needed somebody to find information quickly, so I gave them a mirror. And then the mirror, again, these things happen to me when I'm writing. I put in something, and it's just supposed to be a single practical thing, and the next thing I know, just because it's there, it's taking up hundreds of pages and developing a whole life of its own. But I needed the succubus to work, and I already had a fairly clear idea of, first, there's the classic definition of a succubus, which is simply the, is it the male version? Yes, it's the female version of an incubus. And they're really the same creature, but when it's in taking a male form, it's an incubus, and when it's taking a female form, it's a succubus. And it is a demon that takes the image, an image that will be attractive to you and comes to you in the night and seduces you. And this is, in older times, considered an evil thing. They drain you of energy. I had to really play with that because, again, my audience is modern and they don't see anything scary about somebody coming to lie in your bed with you at night. So I made very clear that it sucks up your energy while it's doing it and eventually kills you. But
So yes. How much of the magic system was rooted in what would have been done at the time or considered to be a realistic thing at the time?
Now, the succubus was a known evil in their concept of the psychic world. It was not, I was not inventing something that the Victorians didn't know about. Everything else I researched.
That's fascinating. So the rituals and like the vessel of power and those aspects.
Well, okay, the vessel of power, you're right. I made a lot of that stuff up. Hey, I didn't account for where he got it. I was forgetting about the vessel of power. To be fair, I spent a great deal of my youth believing in magic, and it was, I never thought it was a good thing, but it was very difficult for my loved ones to convince me it wasn't real. And so, yeah, the vessel of power I sort of made up. If you wanted a really dark magic, how would it work? I've written about magic in a couple of situations, and I always end up coming back to, well, if you did have magic, how would it work? Because I have no interest whatsoever in people just throwing fireballs at each other and, oh, I have power. What do you mean power? Can you plow a field with it? Power's got to do something. That means it's got to have a way of making it work. It is, call it an astral technology.
Right. It's, again, though, it's those details that whether or not they're completely accurate, whether or not you make them up, they are consistent with the rest of the story. And they add such a level of realism to the novel that I, for one, was totally sucked into this book.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Totally sucked in. I read it in like 8 hours. I was like, start to finish. I sat down, read all weekend long, was like, yes. And I think that comes back to, you know, I called it a pulp. It's got the sex, it's got the blood, and it has the hoity-toity Victorian bit. I'm planning on giving this to every woman I know personally. Because
thank you.
I don't know if my husband will like it, but I know every woman I know will like it. The one thing I did find problematic about it is, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, the characters are obviously perfectly willing to use racial epithets, which is completely accurate. But you did use, your main antagonists are Asian. Granted, in their defense, the English characters are pretty much totally vile themselves. But what made you settle on this as the central conflict?
I didn't really stop to think about the prejudice elements. I mean, I knew there was prejudice against, I knew that the English considered the Asians to be inferior. And I hadn't really stopped to think that I had made my bad guys Asian and my good guys white, assuming, as you say, you can call any of them good guys.
Right.
But, and oddly enough, Dr. Chang, when he was first introduced, I had in mind to be mysterious but not a bad guy, really. It's just a little later on I realized he had to be the one who had done this. And then I felt bad about that because I'd always viewed him as sort of glamorous and mysterious and cool. So I tried to make it all his mother's fault. And also there's the political situation. I needed a villain that could go back to the past. And there were all those opium wars and all that ill feeling between China and Britain. And yes, as you say, it was authentic to the period. But I want it on the record now. I do not look down on Asians. I think, to tell you the truth, I would have done anything for a certain hot young Asian man in my day.
Your poor husband.
It was before him, and besides, the guy never even looked twice at me. I was not.
But that is an interesting point, the fact that because you have to root it in history or further back, and there was that huge conflict. That's because there were points where I was like, oh, but I thought Dr. Chang was a good guy. And as you said, you were like, if that's how you started, he is a good guy. And then go to, but unfortunately, he's going to have to be the one that's the bad guy. And then you go a little bit further and going, well, maybe he doesn't have to be a bad guy. We'll go a little bit further in the past and make his mom the bad guy. And I appreciated that because I didn't like her from the beginning.
Thank
so
you.
So mean. So I guess, I guess my question I had, which was wondering whether you're deliberately playing with the Yellow Peril narratives at the time. Maybe you weren't deliberately playing with them, but you certainly might have been aware of them and they might have like crept in.
I didn't deliberately reference them. I knew they were there. They were part of the landscape in which these people moved. And so you could say that they were always an influence. I didn't really consciously have them in mind, though. I tried very, very hard to work in the maiden. Oh, I'm blanking on the name of it. There was a big scandal about young girls being sold into brothels. And I tried so hard to work that in. And I kept coming back to, you know, but they were more worried about the Chinese. Maiden Tribute, that was the name of it. Very major scandal of the era. And I was so mad at myself for not being able to work it in somehow.
Well, you almost get there with Livia and her predicament right at the end. The possibility of her predicament.
I began to feel very sorry for Livia. She had been my least favorite character when I started because she's such a little twit. But boy, did I heap abuse on that poor girl's head.
So true. So that she brings us to the next question, which is the doppelganger aspect of Rhoda and Livia, which I'm not going to give anything away, but could be more than one. That was really creative, but occasionally confusing.
You're not the first to say so.
Right. So from a writer's standpoint, how did you keep track and how do you make sure that your readers can keep track?
For me, it was never an issue. I knew exactly who each of them was, and I never had any trouble distinguishing them at all. I had a lot of fun pointing out that anybody who actually looked, that anybody in the book was going to have trouble with them. But I tried very hard. I spent a lot of work trying to clarify so that the reader would know which one was which, and if nothing else, changing their voices so that... To me, it's always been important that if a character gives a speech, the writer shouldn't really have to say who's speaking. You should be able to tell by listening to them. And certainly with Rhoda and Livia having so much of a doppelganger issue, it had to be very clear in their speech patterns which one was which. That's the real reason that Rhoda was American, because she could have a much thicker accent than Livia did.
Right, and a much more brash attitude.
Exactly. I tried to make them, in terms of their personalities, when I first was working with Rhoda seriously, her primary purpose was to be as different from Livia as I could contrive to make her. And, of course, that turned into a person, too. But, yes, I have been told by a number of people it's not as easy for the reader to keep them straight as it was for me, and I'm sorry about that. I tried.
No, I mean, it was – there were a couple points where I was like, wait a minute, who is she talking about right now? But to be honest, that I think was part of the reason that that doppelganger aspect was so effective, because occasionally you don't know. And you desperately want to know because you want to know who's being affected and what's going on, but they are doppelgangers. Everybody's supposed to be confused.
Yes.
And the characters are confused, so why not the reader being confused occasionally as well?
Why, thank you. I can say that I was referring to the third man where instead of having little subtitles for all the German talk going on around the Orson Welles character, no, not the Orson Welles character, the Joseph Cotton character, instead he's just standing there listening to these people speak German with no idea what they're saying, and you, the audience, get to share that emotion.
Right. The what the hell is going on?
Well, it's all good. Right. It's good. It's immersive.
Yes. Very much so. And Sean here hasn't finished the book, so he doesn't realize quite how potentially confusing it gets. But
I'm enjoying
Sean,
it.
Just hang on to that. There's Livia and there's Rhoda. They're a whole lot alike.
Yes.
I'm enjoying it. So.
That's all that matters. And you have to finish it because it gets nice and juicy.
I will. Don't chill out. Jeez. Just out me on the podcast.
I know. I love doing that to you.
You're mean.
I want Sean to like it. I was a little worried that the novel was too girly. My husband says he liked it. And my girlfriend says her husband grabbed it away from her and read it and said, oh, I didn't expect it to be this good. And wouldn't let her take it back. But...
No, I'm enjoying it. I really like some of that, what Jen was referring to earlier, the sort of pulpiness to it. I kind of compared it at one point to sort of the like Victorian era like sensation novels, and I like it. I like reading something that is trying to play with that. So it's fun.
Well, thank you. Keep on liking it.
No, now I'm just gonna hate it now from now on.
Okay.
Giving me orders.
All right, so that brings me to my last questions, and it's kind of a central theme to the book. Obviously, we just spoke about the doppelganger aspect, but you also have a couple of sets of twins. The two of the main characters, Jacob and Cecily, and Cecily's children end up being twins, and then you have the doppelgangers. So this, you have this theme of identity, you know, confused identity, shared identity, and even hidden identity in the case of one of the twins. What made you choose to focus on this?
Now, way, way back in the beginning, when it's just a story about Jacob and the succubus, I sat down to write, and I suddenly realized that Jacob was going to be too incapacitated to serve as the viewpoint character. So I introduced Cecily simply to be the protagonist, somebody who could do the talking when Jacob was flat on his back. And it became obvious I didn't want to leave the Victorian era, but she still had to be sort of a Victorian Emma Peel. She had to be tougher and broader minded than most Victorian women. And I decided that meant she had to be really intensely close to her brother. And to me, that immediately started talking about a twin bond, because I've always been interested in twins. You could say that I'm the one that's always had identity issues. My husband tells me that I'm a borderline multiple personality disorder. And I've always... I'm not... threatened by a lack of identity. I'm not having the identity crisis we talk about when we're young, But I've always been very conscious that identity is kind of flexible. The edges are very difficult to pin down, and it doesn't take much to change it around. And a lot of it, though, wasn't so much chosen as it was something that was in me, and this was an appropriate, and it was an appropriate tool for what I was writing.
That makes sense. I mean, the mere fact that it is called Mirror Maze. I mean, obviously the mirror aspect, and therefore a twin, and that's it worked really well. But I was surprised to see it come up as often as it did, even past that mirror aspect. I was not expecting Cecily to have twins. I was not expecting what happens to one of her twins. I was not expecting what came out of the mirror. And that blurring, because it gets very blurry, as we were just talking with the doppelganger between Rhoda and Livia. Who is who and what is what? And obviously the demon can shift constantly between the various identities and further confuse that aspect of things.
In a sense, the demon has very little central identity. He is only his shifting facets. Or she, her. I wanted desperately to put in an authentic mirror maze, which were, but they didn't start appearing until 1904. I searched the internet looking for one earlier than that, and I had to give up and say, okay, we'll call it mirror maze, but we won't put a literal mirror maze in there. We'll just mess with people's heads.
That makes perfect sense to me.
By the way, the succubus is a total douche. I'm just saying, like, the mind games damn thing plays, like, that would not happen with me. I would shoot the bastard. And I'd be allowed to carry a gun back in those days.
He's got a surprise in store, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I still don't like him. Like creepy stuff in the bedroom, like comes back as her husband and then is like, I'm gonna pretend to be your brother.
Yeah, that was creepy.
That was creep. I read that and I was like, what the hell's wrong with you?
You know, my girlfriend said that to me after she read it. She said, I'm never gonna feel quite the same about you. What's going on in your head?
This book in turns makes you feel a little bit dirty,
yes,
and a little bit educated.
But kind of in a good way. Like you, for a moment you feel really ashamed of yourself for that, like, sort of that feeling of, like, excitement. And then you're like, you kind of, like, you're like, I'm okay with it. Like, does that make sense?
It definitely helps you get into being. There's a reason that Cecily there is the protagonist. She's you. You get to be her. You get to be the characters that are getting screwed with by the demon.
No pun intended.
No pun intended.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's part of what is, I think what really works for the book is that the way that, I mean, you have, like, all of these sort of characters interacting, and, like, the Victorian setting is really great, but then you have, like, this demon who is, I think, I mean, I would be bloody terrified. Like, at any moment, he could just waltz in and, like, you could be your girlfriend or something. And you would, and unless you were really attuned, you wouldn't know. And so, like, just that constant fear that you're, like, having your life sucked out by this creature because he just happens to be pretending to be someone you like.
I mean, thank you. There's a little tiny bit of John Carpenter's The Thing in there, which in my mind was one of the scariest movies ever made.
I just started thinking, you had to send this in the Victorian times. You are so right. I just realized, I'm like, well, if my husband walked through the door right now and totally unexpectedly and was like, rip your clothes off, and I'd probably have sex with him. And I wouldn't think twice. Why? Because he's my husband. And that's what people do. I suppose not necessarily at noon, but, you know.
In the office.
Right. It wouldn't be unexpected. Well, slightly unexpected, but not shocking.
Exactly.
Hence the Victorian times. Makes so much sense now.
Yeah, and it, of course, I mean, it's put in the same sort of period that a lot of novels that played with these kinds of things during the time, or even later time. I mean, you get like things like the vampire novels, like you got Bram Stoker's Dracula. You have and there are other novels that are written in which these kinds of like women being preyed upon by sort of like raging sex creatures of some description. Usually the sex is not explicit. It's usually as metaphor. Like Dracula is, most people say Dracula is essentially a metaphor for like premarital sex, but of course Dracula is like really freaking creepy. And he like shows up in your house and he's like, hello. And you're like, whoa, stay away from me.
That's just exactly what I meant. When Bram Stoker wrote it, and he's setting it in the Victorian era with Victorian people, Dracula's the scariest thing around. But, you know, now he's the perfect boyfriend.
No, oh, he's my not. God. No, no, no. No, he's not. No. No. Not the perfect
boyfriend.
You don't
even have to get dressed up.
Let's be totally honest here.
And like, he's about to marry, what's her name?
Bella.
And that's, you know, thank you, Bella. And
I'm sorry, Mary Sue, the ultimate Mary Sue. Not, because Bella implies that she has an identity.
Oh.
I gotta correct. Funny. He is not the perfect boyfriend. He is basically like the glittering vampire version of like the white trash guy who like beats his wife.
That's Edward, though. But the narrative now is in most vampire films that he pretty much, maybe not the perfect boyfriend, but I mean, look at Buffy and with Spike and Angel. Even when they're evil, they're still the great boyfriend that she wants to have. Why? Because they're sexy.
Yeah,
but I think maybe there's a little bit different. Is like in the older sort of novels, like say Dracula, there's an aspect of like that these people being preyed upon do actually like a part of them wants to give in
wants
to
it. Yes,
like really wants it. But then that part that's their like Victorian morality or whatever you want to call it is saying no. Whereas in these days, it's sort of like.
It's like, just yes, yes.
It's just kind of like, well, I probably shouldn't because you're not human, but there's nothing
Screw
for
it.
Me to lose either way, so whatever.
There's another really old book I'm going to refer to, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Oh, yeah.
And in it, he had a society which was totally permissive. The point being that the government was deliberately reducing the emotional aspect of primary emotions. The more emotional contacts you had, the less any single one of them meant. The Victorians viewed your sexual contacts, certainly, and even largely your emotional ones, as very intense, important relationships. And now we have 1,000 Facebook friends. And I'm not saying that's bad, but the Facebook friend is not like the friend you had in Victorian era. There's some truth in this concept that if you expand the number of them, there's only so much emotional energy to go around. You use it all up on if you give it all to two or three people, you have really tight relationships. And if you give it to 1,000 people, you have 1,000 nice relationships.
Or, well, I mean, it'd be hard to call them relationships. It's like
you have acquaintances.
1,000 friendly acquaintances. In which you occasionally share a word.
I'm glad to hear you use that word. I haven't heard that word used for years. People don't think in terms of an acquaintance versus a friend anymore. And I'm, like I said, I'm not saying good or bad. It's just I wanted to go back to an era where acquaintance was shallow and friend was very, very tight.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been using the word acquaintance for a number of years because my husband was in the military, so I've moved around. And there's been places where we've had friends, but when you first move, particularly, suddenly you find yourself with many acquaintances. The people that you know are on friendly terms with, might even work with, but aren't sharing your deepest, darkest secrets with.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that, I think you're right in that has probably, to an extent, become much more common. People usually have, you know, those couple of people that they, that's why Sean and I do the podcast though. So I suppose,
well, we're not really friends. We're just acquaintances. Okay.
But friendly acquaintances.
No, we're
no, that denotes something entirely different.
Just kidding. Okay, all right. So we gotta start to close out. So let's end here by asking you what to expect from you in the future, what stories, what novels are coming out soon, hopefully. And of course, where can people find you?
I have a short story called The Once in Future Cake. I call it a time travel romp that will be coming out in Buzzy Magazine next year. And I am currently working on two novels. As I've explained to a couple of people now, I do get writer's blocks. And rather than sit around twisting my thumbs waiting for the movie in my head to start again, I go work on something else for a while. So mm-hmm. I almost always have two things going. And one of them is a book called Invasion, about the arrival of the first aliens on Earth. And I am confident I have told you almost nothing about it with that title. I'm very proud of it. And the other one is another Victorian era, but it's not dark fantasy. It's more steampunk. It's a rollicking adventure in which a girl genius and her girl genius engineer friend go out to find the lost Dutchman's mine. They come all the way from Edinburgh in her exploring machine that they've built, and it's going to be funny and a good deal more lighthearted than this one. And, well, there's always something brewing in my computer. I can't tell you all of it, even if I tried, but those will do for now. As for who I am, friends out there listening, it's M-I-C-H-A-E-L-E. And then Jordan is spelled as you would expect, J-O-R-D-A-N. My website is michaeljordan.com, and my name on Facebook is Michael Jordan. Please feel free to friend me. I love to talk to everybody. And
don't you mean acquaintance you?
Don't misspell the name or you'll get a lot of basketball pictures.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much. I love to hear somebody say they liked it.
Well, that's easy. We only have authors on that we like their work.
Okay.
That's our new rule.
That's our new rule.
Actually, it's always technically been the rule. It's just been never publicly announced. Although it should be implied, because why would you bring somebody on whose work you can't stand?
Yeah,
good point. You know. Well, thank you very much for having me.
No problem. So let's do the closeout, Jennifer. So if anybody yes. wants to email us or send hate mail, which we will send anonymously to Michael. Not really. We don't really send hate mail, but we just offer it in case somebody wants to send us the hate mail, and then we'll laugh at them.
Yes.
But, you know,
hey, they can send the hate mail to my website. I'll be brave about it. It means they read the book, right?
Exactly.
Well,
all right.
They can do that in four ways. So you can give us a Google Plusy thing.
You're screwing with me this week.
I am. I'm going to do that. There you go. Send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.wordpress.com.
Or send us a tweet.
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
And folks may be happy to know that Google Plus added this page feature. So now we have a page where you can follow the podcast as a page too.
Oh, that's good.
So it's on our blog. So you can just go to it's there. It'll be like the big Google Plus sign. It's different than the profile page because it's now just the Skiffy and Fanny. I don't really know. Whatever. I created one because you and Irving told me to do it. So.
Whatever.
Oh,
and I would like to mention that if anybody would like to design us a logo, we would appreciate it. Perhaps we will hold a contest.
Yeah, FYI. That would be cool. No one would do it, but we'll try.
Exactly. All right. So thank you again, Michael. And
thank you.
We will be back next week with something scary.
Terrifying.
Oh, no, that's the week after. I'm sorry. We're reading an awful book by Tyra Banks. Blah. No. Anyway, so let's just go away.
Yes, let's go away. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.